Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is James Stiegel, and I'm joined by my co-host, Darilyn Evans. Today, we're talking with science fiction author M.K. Martin, or as we know her, our co-host, Molly.
Welcome, Molly.
Welcome, Molly.
Thank you. Hello, everybody.
So, you may notice that we are live for this recording, so there may be some interesting little background noises and things of that nature, but we'll do our best to even them out in the post-production. But you're going to get that raw, exciting, live sound. So Molly Martin is a motorcycle riding linguistics nerd. She writes speculative fiction, especially apocalypse and post-apocalyptic sci-fi, and short stories of various genres. When not procrastinating about writing, she enjoys video games and training her daughter to be a ninja or astronaut. Fun fact about Molly, her favorite gene is the Sonic the Hedgehog gene, partially responsible for growing our fingers and toes. We might have to ask about that later. She lists her inspirations as Pierce Brown, Ursula K. Le Guin, George R.R. Martin, who is no relation, but one can dream, Matt Ridley, Stephen King, Brent Weeks, and Barbara Kingsolver. So Molly Martin, welcome to Sentence to Paragraph.
Thank you. I feel like I've been here before.
I know, it's very exciting. And what are we celebrating today, I think, or actually you're in town for what exactly?
So we are celebrating the launch of my book, Survivors Club.
Not just your book, but your first novel.
My first
very
novel.
Very first book launch. Hurrah!
Yeah, that is exciting. And who's the publisher for that?
The publisher is Not a Pipe Publishing. They are an indie publisher out of, ironically enough, Independence, Oregon.
All right. So before we get started, we like to ask authors to read some of their recent work. Were you able to bring something to read today?
I was. I'm going to do a little bit of setup because I'm not starting at the beginning of the book. So up till now, what has happened is our main character, who is Marius, is working for a biopharmaceutical company called Chrysalis. They have sent him out to a remote location under the auspices of picking up Miranda Veers, who is the daughter of the company's CEO. Marius and John Courage, who is the head of security, have run into various mutant and monstrous creatures who have been infected, although they don't understand what's happening quite yet. So, with no further ado, let me start reading. As Marius crept forward, he kept his hand cupped around the light, afraid to be seen, but more afraid to fumble into a dog puma or some other infected animal. The first office was a mess, just as the others above had been. Marius made his way to the next and the next. As he swept the light around, checking for Miranda hiding closets, it reflected off a coral pink fleshy mass in one of the labs. Marius pushed the door open, and the warm meat stink hit him full on. It seemed to be coming from what he took at first to be a sheet of plastic covering the back wall of the lab. Marius stepped closer and saw a ripple pulse through the sheet, coursing purple along dark veins, threading through the pink-red mass. It appeared to be some kind of massive organism. Worse, what Marius had taken for lumps in the wall had distinctly human shapes to them. In fact, a hand protruded from the fleshy wall, the wrist bearing a metal bracelet with the name Isco, May, and a barcode printed on it. Dark veins from the wall penetrated May's hand, pulsing with life. Marius did the only thing a reasonable person could. He vomited for the second time that night. He staggered out of the lab, wiping his eyes and lips. He made the mistake of taking a deep breath and drew in the fetid stench of the place, at once abattoir and birthing chamber. Marius gagged and nearly retched again. Leaning against the wall, he buried his face in the crook of his arm until he could regain control of himself. Miranda isn't in the wall, he thought. She was on the radio. I have to find her, fast, and then we are getting the fuck out. Marius pushed open the door and one of the offices and had to duck to avoid a fire extinguisher to the head. Wait! He leapt back into the hall. I'm Marius, I'm with John! He held up his hands, realized the poker might look scary, and dropped it. It clattered loudly in the silent basement. Miranda covered her mouth as if she could silence it. She was tall with long brown hair and hazel eyes like her father's. She wore a Harrow Hall school uniform and a lab coat over it. The name tag clipped to the pocket read Reyes Carlos. Miranda grabbed Marius's wrist and pulled him into the office. She closed the door, ducked behind the filing cabinet. I had to come down, they're all upstairs, she whispered. I didn't see anyone, I checked the other two floors. Marius folded himself into the corner next to her. Where's John? She asked. Where's the rest of his team? We crashed. The rest of the guys are dead. Well, Wilkes made it, but he... There were these mutant dogs. John and I went upstairs to find the landline, but we found this girl. We didn't think they'd get in, and then... Miranda put a hand over Marius's mouth. A soft click sounded as the doorknob turned. Marius mouthed to her, "Stay here." He got up, hunching down behind the filing cabinet. The door swung slowly open, and a long purplish-black tentacle quested in. As the fat, shiny limb touched the wall, it left a slime trail like a snail's. Marius held out a hand, and Miranda handed him the fire extinguisher. He aimed it at where the tentacle came around the corner and fired a blast of white foam. The tentacle recoiled. "Run!" Marius yelled, bolting into the hall.
So good!
Thank you. I was trying to get as much gross out factor into that section.
I know, we're just getting that out of the way, and I don't want people to think, you know, overall the book is a horror novel, because it's not necessarily, but I think if you enjoy, you know, squishy, creepy things, like, there's definitely things to appreciate in this book. So the place that I wanted to start, we've been focused on world building, as you know, and one of the things that was really interesting to me that we didn't actually talk about in your bio, but I know that you have a military background, and I sort of assume from my own experience that I think of myself times that sometimes as having collected a lot of voices and, you know, characters in the back of your mind that you think of. And one of the things that occurred to me as I was reading was I was hearing a lot of voices that might have seemed like people you might have known, or, you know, starting as a jumping off point. But those were all kind of used as a tool to illustrate the world and do the world building. And so I was kind of curious how you chose those voices, and then how you potentially use that as a tool for your world building.
That's a good, fun, interesting question. so to start at the beginning, yes, a lot of the people that I ran in, that appear in my book are at least based loosely on people that I ran into. And one of the things that I loved about being in the military, especially from the perspective of a writer, is it gave me so much of an opportunity to meet people that I probably would never have met if I was a civilian. They're not the type of people that I normally would have associated with, just because they're from so many different disparate walks of life. So some of the characters are either names that I met in the military, names of people that I met in the military, or definitely personalities of people that I met in the military. The one that I have to bring up particularly is John Courage. So when I was in the Army, I actually knew a Captain Courage, and my publisher told me, "This is ridiculous. Nobody will be named Captain Courage. You can't make this stuff up." And so we went back and forth and back and forth, and I'll leave it to the fans whether or not they believe that Captain Courage should be named Captain Courage. So the jury's still out on that one. So yeah, in that sense, the world building, it's a lot of stuff that you draw from life experience and then make it your own. So be careful what you do around authors.
So I actually got ahead of myself, and I was going to say some background where we've talked with some far future science fiction authors, and then also some secondary world fantasy authors, and sort of the challenges in creating a completely different world from our own, you know, using touch points and things that readers would recognize. Your book is, you know, pretty firmly near future, that then moves into almost a, or will eventually move into kind of a secondary post-apocalyptic world. So you're leading the reader into this world. Are there some things that you thought about when you were choosing, you know, how to enter that story and how to build the world around that, those ideas, and knowing where you want to go eventually?
For me, especially in the first book, like you said, there's not a lot that's different from our world. The main things that I did was scale up the technology slightly, and then take great liberties with the actual science and viruses and things like that as to what is possible. I tried to keep it close enough based in fact that it could pass the sniff test, but obviously viruses don't turn people into monsters with tentacles, at least that we know of. Yet.
Wait till Antarctica flips. Yeah. Pause a bit more.
So as far as world building, this is more of a world tearing down and then a world rebuilding. As you said, it's an apocalypse that the reader gets to experience along with the character. So as the character is learning about what is new and changed in the world, the reader is also learning about it at the same time. So they get to go along with the viewpoint character and have that experience rather than being told, this event happened thousands of years ago and now this is the result of it. I don't remember what the rest of the question was.
Well, I think in leading people through to the new world, but as you're talking about that, I'm wondering, are there specific tropes that you wanted to get into that process of, world building that the readers are going to recognize as, apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic?
I wanted to play around with the trope of the scientist. So mm-hmm. That's one of the things, especially in, fans of The Walking Dead will recognize, or Resident Evil or anything else, where you sort of have this evil scientist who does crazy unethical experiments and we're all going to die as a result. And it's sort of something I think we've been grappling with ever since Frankenstein first appeared on the scene, the idea that science could ultimately doom us all. So we have some characters in the book like Dr. Veers and Dr. Rasmussen who are those characters, who are sort of cavalier in their pursuit of science and really sees science as a means to an end rather than something that's more pure and an intellectual pursuit. And Marius's character is more of what I think of as the good scientist, who his great sin in the story is more of his innocence and trusting nature, that he doesn't understand the potential of what his experiments and what his knowledge can be taken advantage of.
I have to ask, have you ever played Half-Life?
Yes. Yes, video games. So those are a lot of my influences, and things like post-apocalyptic stories, mm-hmm. Contagion. I want the scientist to be a sympathetic character, not always the bad guy, not always the one in the lab coat that's destroying the world.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that I did really enjoy this, I don't want to say unexpectedly, because I'd already seen pieces of it, and of course I love your writing. But typically the zombie apocalypse stories are not my genre, but neither is military fiction, and so I was a little nervous walking into this. But I felt like you, I guess, playing with those tropes, did a really great job of navigating that. A nice amount of gore, but not too gory, but believable. I did like what you did with the science and making the scientists working for good, but also the military part of this. That a lot of military fiction, it feels like, it is. Military for military's sake, and the civilians are just worthless or no good or not. They're not worth much in this story, and I really liked that they are the mission in this story, and there is some care about the civilians, even if they do occasionally make really bad choices in the face of events going down. But I really liked that focus. It wasn't just that hard military machismo that we often get.
Well, thank you.
But you did a great job with that.
I think one of the things that helped me do that is to have the character of Torres, who originally was just there to give me an outside perspective on Marius and then just kind of took over and decided she definitely wanted to be a part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I think having them as military people who are working for a civilian corporation helped me to be able to translate things. So they have military jargon and military methods of communication that they can use amongst themselves, but they also have to communicate with the civilians in the story. So that was kind of my way of translating to readers, who are most of them civilians, of this is the military jargon, so you get the flavor, and this is what it means, so you can also have some context. Marius was also a fun character for me to do that with, to use him as a viewpoint character, because there is a couple times in the story where he goes on these very sort of technical rants of trying to explain this and that scientific theory or what this virus is doing, and then the rest of the characters don't understand and he has to explain in plain English to them. So it was a fun way for me to give the flavor of he knows what he's talking about, but you also need the information in a way that you as the reader without a PhD can understand.
Nicely done.
Well, thank you.
So what was the, when you thought about doing a you know, evil biological corporation sort of story. Like, what made you choose that as your entry point into the apocalyptic event? You know, was there something interesting about that? Do you have, like, particular worries about you know, the CDC and their funding and things like that? Or, you know, what led you to that?
I think a couple of things, sort of what's going on in our environment right now with the sort of growing distrust in science, and also the growing tendency of us to see science again as a vehicle, you know, as a means to an end, and not necessarily science for the sake of curiosity or for exploration or for the betterment of man, of more of, you know, how can we take this drug and then charge, you know, 6,000% of market value? And so there's a lot of concern that I have around that, of mm-hmm. science being used and science being monetized in a way, and then putting people where the benefits of science are outside of their grasp. So I wanted to discuss that, but I also didn't want to have this just as a faceless evil corporation. Marius himself is a part of the corporation. Miranda's the daughter of the CEO. John is the head of security. These are all characters who are the good guys of the story. They're the main characters of the story, and they very much are a part of this corporation. So I wanted to show that there's more complexity. It's not just a big evil corporation.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting how a lot of them had, you know, were former military, and so that was something where that's a pretty viable career when you leave, you know. And I think, was it Torres that is thinking about, I think, that, you know, how much money she makes compared to, you know, being with a private corporation versus being in the military, mm. and, you know, how many times she was traded one sandbox for another. And that all felt very, you know, real to me. So I thought that was, that worked well, you know, really well for me.
Thanks.
Are there any, you know, so you talk about video games, are there any other things that you know, I mean, we're just in this, like, glut of post-apocalyptic work right now, so is there anything else that you chose as a model or as stepping off point, or anything you wanted to, you know, be, like, in counterpoint to? Like, you mentioned The Walking Dead, like, do you want to be The Walking Dead, or do you want to be something that's, you know, in conversation with The Walking Dead?
I would say, you know, ambitiously, I want to be bigger than The Walking Dead. Of course, that's a totally realistic expectation. Mm-hmm. But I think in conversation with The Walking Dead is more of what I'm looking for. It's more of a different take on what would happen. One of the things that I want to consider with my story, and if anybody hasn't watched The Walking Dead, I won't give any spoilers away, but there are often times in The Walking Dead where characters seem to die for no reason. And I think that that's important to show in sort of having a verisimilitude to what would this environment be like. No holes barred, civilization has collapsed, there's danger around every corner. Occasionally people are going to die for stupid reasons. And I have that in my book. But with the main characters, I wanted to have care that if there are main characters who die, they don't die for stupid reasons, or they don't die for no reason. And again, no relation to George R. R. Martin, but I think he gets a lot of heat for that kind of thing as well, of these dearly beloved characters who get killed off. And he's got that well covered, so my dearly beloved characters don't die for no reason.
I appreciate that. Well, we kind of heard that from Mike Cooper last time, that you don't break up the team and you
don't break up the team.
Yeah. You know, I shouldn't, I used a negative word earlier. I shouldn't say glut, because I think there's a reason that post-apocalyptic fiction speaks to people right now. And it's funny how it seems to be in response to the world at large that mm. is continuing on. And obviously there's I think in a way of seeing a world that's tougher than the one we have now, it actually makes people feel better.
It could be worse.
I know, it could be worse. There could be dog pumas running around eating our faces.
You could have people in flesh walls with exactly. tentacles growing out of them. So, yeah.
Is there something in particular that drew you to that? Why that particular story rather than, you know, fluffy bunnies or some kind of fantasy or, you know, futuristic spaceships and whatnot? Why this story?
The first book that I ever loved in high school. So as everyone does, I had to take literature in high school English, and we read a lot of crap. And the first book that I ever loved was The Stand. And that was a book that I actually not only read the assignments and completed them, but read ahead. And ever since then, I have loved the post-apocalyptic genre. And I heard something really interesting, and I wish I could remember who had said it, but somebody was talking about how post-apocalyptic stories are actually very hopeful and optimistic stories. Because they are a way for us to say, the worst has happened, and we've survived, and we can rebuild. Mm-hmm. So I agree with James, what you were saying, that, you know, maybe we're looking at this as a way of, now is a time of uncertainty in our own culture. There's a lot of anxiety about where we're going to go, what's going on in our environment, what's going on in our economy and our political situation. And part of the post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic stories that we're seeing is an exploration of those fears. But I think it's also a hopeful note of saying, even if things do get bad, we could rebuild. Things could be better after this. We could start over. We could correct some of the wrongs that we've made. And what would that look like?
What would that look like?
And that's all I got to say about that.
Better not be.
So this is the first of a trilogy, is that right?
Yes.
Talk about that.
Talk about
developing
that.
Developing your storyline and whatnot.
So, again, in the spirit of the post-apocalyptic and apocalyptic genre, what I wanted to do with the story is have three books where you sort of have the entirety of the thing. So a lot of stories in post-apocalyptic genres is there's been an event, you know, several generations ago, long enough ago that we don't know what cars are anymore or whatever the case may be. And so it's just this far distant thing and you have this lack of knowledge of what's happened. At the other end of the spectrum is here's the apocalypse and it's really, really bad. And at the end of it, everybody's dead. So I wanted to have a story where you could follow characters throughout the whole thing and see them rebuilding at the end of it. And in order to do that, I knew that you had to have something that would be fairly fast acting, that couldn't be incredibly destructive of everyone. So I couldn't drop nukes on everybody, because then everybody would be mutated and not just the infected. Similarly, I couldn't, you know, drop a comet or an asteroid on the planet and wipe everybody out. So I had to have something where civilization could collapse and people could still survive that, and people could still rebuild afterwards. But it had to happen fast enough that it could happen within the span of their lifetime. So, a virus.
Perfect.
Yeah. I like it. Plus, I studied biology in college, and that's kind of my first love. I highly recommend for anybody who's writing science fiction, go study biology. And if you don't get some ideas from that, maybe don't write so much science fiction.
Well, it's terrifying, really. Yeah. And
thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I guess since we're there, let's talk a little bit about craft. As you were writing this, so did you write all three books before you sent it out, or did you plot them all out, or did you write book one and send it out and then go, oh, how do I finish the rest of this?
Did I plot them out? Did I plot them out? She asks. No. I don't plot. That would be silly. So the first book I actually wrote as a NaNoWriMo book. And for those of our listeners who don't know, NaNoWriMo is National Novel Writing Month. That happens in November, and you try to write a book in a month. And so I'd written the first draft of this as a NaNo book and just wrote as fast as I could and had to do much editing afterwards to get the book into any kind of publishable shape. Once I was, and I knew at the beginning that I wanted to tell the story of an apocalypse, that I wanted the first book to be, this is how the apocalypse, you know, these are the events leading up to it. The second book is going to be, this is the apocalypse itself. And the third book is, you know, this is us trying to rebuild afterwards. So other than that, I didn't have much of an outline. What I found in book two is that I did have to do a lot more plotting for book two, which the first draft of book two is complete, in that I have to think about what happened in book one, what are any potential consequences, what plot lines are left hanging from book one, what questions haven't been answered in book one, and address those while also bringing up any new questions. So the idea is each book can reasonably be a standalone story, so they have to be complete stories in and of themselves, but also there have to be larger themes and larger questions that carry on from book one through book two and be ultimately answered in book three or not.
Oh. did you have, as you were writing book one, did you already have a sense of all of those bigger themes? I mean, obviously the bigger arc of beginning, apocalypse, and rebuild, but were there some other bigger questions that you had in mind there, or did you kind of get, after book one, did you go, okay, here are these themes that I want, and then do you thread them back into book one, or are you just making those as you go, book two and book three?
It's a little bit of both, honestly. In book one, there was a lot more of threading themes in during revision, again, because book one was written so quickly, and it was a lot more of a discovery. For example, the character of Torres that I mentioned before was a character that I had just originally written her as an outside perspective on Marius so that the reader could see him through somebody else's eyes. And then she just took on a life of her own and began to carry a lot of the story, especially in book two and book three. So that was a pleasant surprise. Some of the themes that I've developed as I've been writing book two, I realized in completing book two that then I needed to set those up in book one. So during revisions, I had to go back and pepper some things into book one. So I would say, as far as craft goes, just get your first draft down and don't worry about being fancy and having themes and all of that kind of thing. Because if they're there, they're going to be there. And if they're not, and you discover afterwards that you have themes that you want to discuss, you can put them in afterwards.
Great.
Now, you were working with a writing group as well, right? Through the kind of editing process. Did you find that that was helpful, that it got in the way, that, you know, is outside feedback useful? Because then, even after all that, you still had to go through an editing process with the publisher, right? Mm. So, if you could do it over again, would you just have written that first draft and, you know, given it to the publisher? Or, you know, what would you say about that?
I would say if you have the opportunity to work with a writing group, definitely take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. Even though I had, my publisher has editors, and we also made some changes after the fact. One of the things my publisher actually said that encouraged him to ask for the full manuscript after he had read a couple chapters was the fact that he said, this is very polished, I'm not going to have to do a lot of work on that. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason it was as polished as it was because my writer's group had already been through it a couple of times and helped me get out a lot of the major kinks. So for example, the beginning has been rewritten at least three or four times to get to the place where it is now. And in my nano draft, I didn't even have the climactic scene of the story in the nano draft at all. So what had happened was there was a chapter and then from one character's point of view, and then another chapter from a different character's point of view, and that second character talked about in narration, oh, by the way, this is what happened previously in this big ultimate showdown of the entire book. And my writers group jumped all over that and said, you owe us another chapter. So that was definitely a good catch on their part.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, though, if you're taking something to a writers group, do be aware of the fact that if you're getting multiple suggestions, you as the writer yourself, as the arbiter of your own book, have to take all of that with a grain of salt. And if those suggestions don't serve your vision, feel free to just completely ignore them and smile at the person who is suggesting them.
And she's looking at me as she says that.
What?
Dang. Well, would you say that, so having kind of done, you know, exploration writing, did you come to a point where you felt like you had, like, this is, I have a vision of this book now, you know? Or, like, I guess, is it difficult to sometimes know where that boundary is with people? Like, oh, that's a great idea, I should totally do that. This is mine, that's not going to work.
Well, for my book, there's a couple different ways that the writers in my writers group brought their material to the group. Some of them were giving us chapters as they wrote them. And I think with those writers, they tend to, it's easier for them to get influenced by suggestions, because if you're bringing stuff to a writer's group, you're bringing material to a group of creative people and they have wonderful and amazing ideas. Not all of those wonderful and amazing ideas are right for your book. And so if you're bringing a work in progress to the group, you just have to guard against letting it be sort of the horse by committee story. Mm-hmm. When I brought my book to the group, I had completed the first draft. So I already had a vision in my mind. So I was able to measure suggestions when I got them from people against the vision that I had in my mind. So let's say that one of the other writers said, I think this character should do X, Y, or Z, but I know in three chapters a different event is going to happen. Or they would say, I think, you know, this character needs to get killed in this scene or to survive this scene, but I knew that down the road something else had to happen with this character. They had to be able to do this or that. So I could look at those suggestions and say, is this serving my story? And so for me, that was really worthwhile to have, and also very gratifying, especially when they would guess right. Mm-hmm. They would say, oh, I think this character should do this. And I'm like, they're going to in three chapters. You're going to be really happy about that.
So in working, you know, it sounds like you started from an idea. You didn't necessarily start from a market perspective, or maybe you already had that in the back of your mind. Like, did you start from, I want to write a post-apocalyptic book, or was it just, this is the book I want to write, and approached it from that direction?
It was more of, this is the book that I want to write. Mm-hmm. So taking Stephen King's advice of write the book that you want to read. Mm-hmm. So this way, at least you'll have one reader that's happy. You can always, if you can just have that one reader that's happy, even if it's just yourself, you've done good, your success as a writer. So don't let anybody ever tell you otherwise. I think for this, James, you had mentioned the genre, the post-apocalyptic genre, especially nowadays, it's actually pretty saturated, especially ever since 28 Days Later came out. People are like, oh, wait, zombies, that's kind of a cool idea again. And then with The Walking Dead and the Resident Evil series that's been going on for a while, movies like Contagion. So there's a lot of interest in that and in zombies in particular. And I've been told multiple times that the genre is already saturated, the market is already full, don't even try, wait a couple years. But here's the thing, if you chase the market, if you're always trying to write for the market, you're never going to be on top, you're never going to hit that trend. The other thing that I would say is it doesn't seem like people are becoming any less interested. So even if the genre is already saturated, that's because there still seems to be a lot of demand for this story. So if you have a story to tell, that's the story that you need to tell. And if it doesn't find a publisher right away, stick it in a drawer, write another story, and then pull it back out in a couple years and try again.
Yeah, I don't think that the demand for post-apocalyptic is going anywhere. Mm. So that's what's so interesting about it, is what a reflection it is of us as readers and what people, you know, what they find is escape. Or
maybe it's more of a how-to guide, you know? People are worried. They're like, okay, what are we going to do I don't know, we're in Oregon, so what are we going to do when the big earthquake happens?
So I came to post-apocalyptic, I guess, more through Resident Evil, Half-Life, Left 4 Dead, so from a gaming perspective.
Yeah.
And I hate zombies. I hate zombies in games. I hate zombies. I hate tower defense games where I have to defend against, you know, hundreds of zombies coming after me. And so that was one of the things that I really appreciated, actually, were a lot of moments where I felt like the characters were going to get overwhelmed. But, you know, that I guess that does lead to a question, is how, or did you specifically approach your world building, or even as you kind of went through the book, developing that ongoing sense of dread? And I think for a certain reader, as soon as I see, you know, a mesa in the desert with a secret laboratory in there, I'm like, oh, it's going down. Like, you're on the 15th level? Oh, no, you don't want to be there. You want to be on the top, you know. I don't want to live on the 50, you know, 20th level down. I'm going to die. So I think, was that in your mind? Like, looked at, like, different decisions about, like, every time a character might pass through a checkpoint, or even then going into the basement of the school, it's like, don't go in the basement.
Don't go in the basement.
School.
Never go in the
What's
basement.
What's wrong with you? Like, as soon as you approach and you see broken windows, like, what are you doing? Which I will say, I thought your characters always made decisions for intelligent reasons, but from a gaming perspective, that was kind of the first thought I had. And that's, I think, for this genre, that is a really you know, a thread that has to run through the world building is that sense of dread that you're right, there is, you know, fear around every corner and how am I going to overcome this? I mean, is that something that you went back through and added, you know, looking for those details, or is it something that just kind of came to you as you were writing, since you'd been really steeped in that genre?
Well, I'd like to say that I'm just innately brilliant and all of it came out just during the first draft, but that would be a monstrous lie. So the big place where I went through with intentionality and wrote some dread into the story is actually the opening. My original story was that terrible cliche of driving to the scene where the characters are just kind of sitting in an office and then somebody shows up and they spend a lot of time talking and then they get in a car and they're traveling around for a while. And it was terrible, but it was what I needed to write to understand the characters. When I rewrote the opening scene, one of the things that I wanted to do in the new opening was to immediately show that characters are going to be in danger and that the stakes are real and that bad things will happen and that there's going to be some gross things in this story. So I wanted to envelop the reader in a sense of the world and give them that sense of dread that this isn't just going to be a happy, shiny story. And to also show that there are going to be characters that they care about who are going to be in danger right away. So if your opening isn't everything that you want it to be, feel free to rewrite it 5 or 6 times.
Well, is that a place where the having a writer's group helped?
Yeah. It did, yeah. And also attending a writer's conference. I think it was through a WordCrafters conference. I had brought my first few pages into a conference, and one of the authors here, they were doing a panel, and they would read a few pages, and they would give you some feedback on a few pages. And so I brought in my opening, and that was the feedback that I got. I wish I could remember her name. I think it was Tina Connolly. It might have been somebody else. Gave me valuable advice. They were quite kind in their review of my first few pages, probably kinder than they needed to be. But what she said to do was, she said, go back, brainstorm 10 ideas of how this story could open, and you will find the way that you want to open it within those 10 ideas. And I actually only had to get to 6 before I knew what I needed to do. But without that, I think we would have had a much less exciting opening. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about, I guess, craft, but also the role of classes and conferences and whatnot in your writing development?
Sure. Actually, I wouldn't have met my publisher if it wasn't for a conference. I had gone to a conference for Willamette Writers, which is where I met my publisher. I had just gone through and submitted my story for manuscript critique, and he and I sat down and we talked about it. And then he told me the history of the word orange, and I told him I was a linguist, and it was just publishing love at first sight.
Awesome.
Yeah. So the greatest benefit that I got from the various conferences, the WordCrafters Conference and the Willamette Writers Conference, was in going to the first few conferences that I went to, where I was completely convinced that my story was 100% ready to go and I should already have been awarded the Pulitzer, was finding the few places that I still needed to tweak tiny, tiny, tiny little things. Mm-hmm. And once I made those changes, then just finding an environment where aspiring writers and aspiring publishers can get together.
And that's Willamette Writing Festival? That one's in Portland every year, right?
It's the Willamette Writers Conference.
Conference, yeah. Okay.
Excellent organization. Mm-hmm. And that is the first weekend of August every year, mm-hmm. in Portland.
Yep.
So you met your publisher. You then had to embark on a second process of editing. How difficult was that? And were there times when you were like, nope, you're wrong? Because I think you went through some pretty serious changes, right? Weren't there tense?
Oh, yes.
There was actually even tense changes and POV changes.
Yeah. So yeah. One of the first things that my editor or my publisher said is, we're going to have to change all of this from first person perspective to third person. And I said no, because George R.R. Martin can write with multiple point of view characters, and so can I, because my last name is also Martin. But I am not George R. R. Martin. So my publisher said, well, just give it a try and see how it works. And it turned out that he was right. And so I had to take the whole book from first person perspective, multiple point of view characters, to third person. And to try to smooth out the point of view characters so that it was more of a standardized experience for the reader. So that was a big time consuming edit that had to be made. There were a couple other minor edits that I was willing to make. There's a couple of characters who got renamed, not John. I had to plant my flag on some hill. I was like, you know what, this is the hill I can die on. So John Courage remains John Courage. Also, I had several of my writer group friends, fellow writers, who, when I said that we were thinking of renaming the character, got quite upset and backed me up on that. And mm-hmm. I think a few of them actually emailed my publisher on my behalf. So this is another place where your writer's group is invaluable.
The true value of right there.
Yeah. So as far as the editing process went, I'm also a freelance editor, and I found that it is way easier to edit anybody else's work, but not your own. So it was really good to have other editors looking over my stuff, because I'd gotten to the point where I'm like, oh yeah, it's completely perfect. And then I got back their edits and realized that it was not, you know, maybe 97%.
So you did agree, you agreed with them, or were you like, no, this person doesn't know what they're talking about?
I agreed with much of what they said. There were a couple times where I was just like, nope, it's just, this is the way it's going to be. And a lot of that actually was dialogue, especially military or jargony kind of dialogue, like scientific dialogue or military dialogue, where if I felt that that is the character's voice, that is just the way that that character talks, then I would stand firm on that. My publisher was pretty good about that. There were a couple places where we went back and forth about rewording some things, and a couple of arguments that I won and several arguments that I did not do as well on.
Do you think you grew as an editor in this process?
I did, yes. I learned about appreciating the Oxford comma more.
Okay.
Oxford comma.
Yes, I'm pro Oxford comma. The other thing that I found is that I have way too many characters in my story whose names end with the S sound, and pluralizing that, or making that possessive, becomes difficult, because then when you do you say Marius, like Marius's, and then do you write it S comma S, or S apostrophe S? So. those are the really important decisions that editors have to wrestle with.
Get as many
with.
S's in there as you can. Just, yeah, make them do that.
Just completely sibilant.
Yep.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the research that you did, and when and where you did that in your writing process? Like, so you did the Nano novel. Did you already have a bunch of research done before you went in, or did you kind of write, this is going to be something about viruses? Sciencey, or whatnot. I assume you have the military aspect down as a former military, but did you do that? Did you already have it from your biology background, or where and when did that happen, and how much did you end up needing to do?
So some of the biology stuff was my first love was biology, and that's what I studied before I joined the Army. So that was an interest of mine. And as James mentioned in my introduction, one of my favorite authors is Matt Ridley. And what he writes is books about genes and science and things like that. He was, I think his most famous book is, I think it's called The Devil in the Freezer. And it talks about an outbreak of Ebola that happened in Reston, Virginia. And, So that was one of the things that I was very interested in, and a lot of those things I already knew because I'm just a nerd and I like to read about viruses. And then the other thing, and again, this is me waving my go to writers' conferences little flag, is while I was at the writers' conference, I met a wonderful gentleman from Florida, and what he does is he's a microbiologist by trade, and he had also written a book about a zombie apocalypse. And so the two of us bonded over zombie apocalypse novels, and then I learned about his background, and I said, could I send you my novel and get your feedback on it? And he proved to be an invaluable resource. So a lot of the things he would come back and say, well, this is how scientists would actually talk about this. So all the really smart-sounding parts of the book that are very scientifically accurate sounding are probably a direct result of his cooperation and helping me out.
That's great, actually.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be smart about everything. You just have to know people and be able to Google.
That's going to be the pull quote for the interview. So having gone through all what feels like a very long process for this book, I mean, what kept you motivated through all of it? And obviously, you know, publishing it is a big motivator, but then working on book two while you're editing book one, where did you find your motivation through everything?
Well, after the character survived book one, and by the end of NanoDraft, it's amazing that any of them did. I was ready to kill them all. I put the book away, and I didn't look at it again for a couple of months, which is the only reason that any of them survived to book two. And then I pulled it out again, and I read it over, and I was like, not all of this is terrible. And I like the characters. I want to find out what their story is. And the fact that sometimes they still surprise me. I have an agenda in my mind of where I'd like the story to go, and then I start writing, and they've just decided that they're going to do something completely different. So that's really fun for me. As far as the motivation to keep writing, I don't think we as writers can help it. It's kind of an addiction. It's not so much of how do you find the motivation to keep writing, but when do you run out of excuses to not write and finally get back to writing?
But you've also got a little person at home who might make it difficult to write. I guess this might move us into some of the process questions, but can you talk about how you find the time to write and how you sort of structure your day or what tools you use to make that, to make it happen?
Well, with my little person, part of the reason that book two got done was because I was writing it while I was pregnant with my little person, and I knew that once she came into the world, I would have no time to write after that. So I really tried to take advantage of all the time that I had to get some writing done, and then when she arrived, I took a big break for a while, just focusing on her and sleep. So those were my two big things, eating, sleeping, and baby. And then after that, when she got a little bit older and a little bit more independent, it was good to come back to it. It's something that I want her to be proud of. I want her to know that, you know, being a parent, being a mother, it's not the only thing that you can do and you can be. It's important for me to see that it's important for me that she see that I can be a good mother and I can also be something else.
Yeah, you mentioned that Ursula K. Le Guin is a mentor or a, you know, an idol for you, and that was certainly one of her. That was always really inspiring about her, that she'd be a great parent and really focused on being, you know, wanted to be seen as a parent who was also, you know, an author. So that's something I don't know. I see as a great. I really look up to the fact that she accomplished so much and was still able to be a parent. So. Yeah. Huh, but you do sneak off to coffee shops and things quite a bit, right?
I have to. So I know that there are some writers who can write at home. I'm not one of those people. I have to leave, partly because of my video game problem. So if I'm at home, there are video games available. There are also chores that need to be done. There's also little people that need to be attended to. There's also family obligations that need to be met and so forth and so on. So for me, the space that I can write in is that space out in the world, out in a coffee shop. And the other thing that I have to do is I have a program on my computer that blocks social media. I can set up a blacklist of sites, so it blocks various game applications, social media sites, anything like that. So I have my blacklist. And once I turn it on, I can set an amount of time, and I can't access those sites again until that amount of time is up. So I sort of have to provide my own purpose, direction, and motivation to write. So being a former non-commissioned officer, that helps, because that was our mission in the Army. Now I just do it to myself since I don't have any privates.
I was just experimenting with a couple of those little things. I found one that's like a little owl that will, like, you know, chastise you if you don't do what you're supposed to do. It shuts off the websites.
What writer doesn't need a judgmental owl?
I know.
I just want the one that gives me a kitten every time I write, make my writing goal.
So you're more of a positive reinforcement instead of a negative reinforcement.
Chocolate and kittens. What more could you ask?
Every 100 words, you can have a little piece of chocolate.
There you go. So do you have, besides zombies, do you have any obsessions as a writer, particular subjects or themes or ideas you're working at or that you're aware of?
That I'm aware of. I don't know. I think if you asked my mom, it would be writing stories that aren't happy. My mom asked me why I can't write any happy stories, and I think she's a bit concerned about how my childhood worked out, that all of my stories tend to be pretty grim and gritty. I don't see it that way. I see stories as a way of working through our various issues, and ultimately, again, sort of the idea that post-apocalyptic stories are actually very optimistic. So I don't see it as a very dark story. I mean, a lot of terrible things happen, but that's sort of the crux of stories, is that they have to have conflict, they have to have opportunities for the characters to grow and change, and to be put in situations where they have to face who they truly are, and the more extreme the situation is, the more likely they're going to come to face with themselves and their inner demons. And so stories that are sort of cozy and fluffy and happy and end with chocolates and or have chocolates and kittens throughout, less likely to wrestle any inner demons in those stories. Maybe they can have chocolates and kittens at the end.
Probably a good point.
I think that Angela Lansbury wrestled with a lot of demons in Murder, She Wrote. Mm-hmm. And there was murder.
There was a lot of murder.
Quite a lot of murder.
There's probably a higher survival rate in my books than there is in Murder, She Wrote.
This is true. That's an interesting way of looking at it.
So you'd be safer in Chrysalis than you would in what's the town in Murder, She Wrote?
Oh shoot, I don't remember. I'm like, that's
we'll have to look it up.
Cred. Yeah,
listeners, you will get a prize for the first of you that calls in with the correct answer.
Parrot Bay, something. Oh, I don't remember. Oh, that's funny. Let's see. So we talked about writing conferences. Are there any other resources or teachers that have been a big help to you in your writing?
So one of the things that I did when I first got serious about writing, is I took a class from Linda Clare, who was teaching through Lane Community College at the time. And it was a very basic intro to fiction class. And at that point, I already had a college degree, and I'd gotten out of the military, so I had a pretty high opinion of myself and my writing ability. And I actually learned a lot in her class. And the other thing that I'm immensely grateful to that class for is I met other writers. So even if there's not a lot that you can learn, there's a lot of connections that you can make. And that's one of the ways that I ended up in a writer's group, is through that class. The other classes that I'm very grateful that I took, or writing mentors that I have in my life, is Eric Witchie does these amazing classes where he talks about how to manipulate, or how to use the reader, the character's emotions to manipulate the reader's emotions. And he does it incredibly well, and I still haven't figured it out, but I try to take all of his classes, and eventually I'm going to crack that secret.
So you talked about when you got serious about writing. So can you tease out that moment a little bit more? Like, what was it that, led you to that decision?
So I started writing when I was probably 6 or 7, so about the time that I learned to read, because it hadn't occurred to me that people would read stories and then not create their own stories also. I didn't understand that reader and writer was separate for several years. And I went to a library, and they had the summer reading program, and they gave you stickers, and you got to color in, so many bubbles, and every time you got 5 bubbles colored in, you got a little prize. And so it was this amazing exploration into writing into reading, and I wanted to be part of that world. I wanted to create stories. This is just something that I loved, being able to explore and being surrounded by stories. So I'd always written until I got to about high school and college, and then was much busier with more important things, boys, college, things like that, that ultimately did not turn out to be as important as I thought they were. And I stopped writing for a long time, And then I went to Iraq, and I wanted to finish a story. I had never finished a story before, and something about getting mortared that makes you think, you know, if I'm going to finish a story, now would probably be a good time to do that. So I finished a short story. The first thing that I'd ever finished was something that I wrote at least partly in the turret of a Humvee in Iraq. And when I came back, I had this sense of accomplishment because I had this story that I'd finished. And now I'm like, I finished a story. I'm a writer. And even though nobody knows this yet, I know this. And so then I just kept writing. Taking Linda Clare's class was helpful, getting involved with the NaNoWriMo process, because I already had this sense of accomplishment of, I can write a short story, I can finish something, but can I finish a novel? And NaNoWriMo is a great place to do that, because you're expected that your novel is going to be terrible. It's totally okay. It just has to be done. That's the main thing. So that's kind of where I got a little bit more serious, was in finishing that novel.
How has writing changed for you, moving from those first explorations of writing and that awesome accomplishment of finishing the short story and then the novel at NaNoWriMo, but you know, still without that pressure of publishing or an audience sitting out there? How has it changed now that you are a published novelist?
I don't know. It's such a new thing for me still. I think the biggest thing is knowing that there are people in the world who are waiting for the story. So there wasn't that pressure before, except for having a writer's group, which is a really good pressure to have, is that it's positive peer pressure, accountability, because writers, I think, first and foremost, are procrastinators and dreamers. And so having that accountability piece is essential, whether that accountability is to you or whether that's to another group of people. So now that the novel is out there, the second novel has to come out, because it's a trilogy. So the second one, if there's a book one, there must be a book two. And if there's a book two, there must be a book three. So knowing that there's pressure, not pressure, but good pressure, she says inelegantly. I'm a writer, not a speaker.
Uh-huh. So, you know, you talk about the trilogy. What are some other kind of long-term plans that you would like to have?
After this, I think I'm going to delve more into what I think of as more hardcore sci-fi, in that it's sort of, I'm very interested in, let's say, space marines or military sci-fi. I don't think I'm gonna... I love reading fantasy, and I've written fantasy short stories, but I just don't have a fantasy story to tell right now. So I think I'm gonna stick in the sci-fi genre for a while.
So as you said, you're still in the middle of figuring this out, but how do you manage the business of being M.K. Martin and author and writing life of M.K. Martin?
So what I will say is, if you are writing a book, even if you don't think it will ever get published, do some of the work now before it gets published. The things that I applaud myself for doing ahead of time and not procrastinating about is, I wrote my author bio, I had professional pictures taken, I created a website. So those are the things that I'm happy about, that I don't have to worry about now that the book is out there in the world. Some of the things that I wish I had done more of is listen to my social media marketing guru friend, Kristen Ammerman, who knows everything about how to market. And she has numerous good ideas, some of which I may even do.
Well, that's a good question. Have you found social media to be useful? Because it sounds like you've really been, you know... The writing is important, and the social media stuff maybe is not as important, or is not. Is that your passion, would you say, or do you have a passion there?
I would not say that I have a super big passion for social media. I would much rather. So my ideal marketing strategy is to put a box of books on the side of the road and hope that people take them and that they would maybe kindly send me some money for it, and never shall we speak to each other. I'm a bit of an introvert, so... That sounds like the perfect social way to promote a book to me. Unfortunately, in this day and age, realistically, if you're going to be an author, especially if you're not represented by one of the big publishing houses, you're going to have to engage in social media. You're going to have to do something like that. So what I would say is find the things that you enjoy anyways and focus on those. Don't try to use all of the platforms. You will just be overloaded and unhappy. You won't engage with them in a way that's meaningful to your readers. So I just stick to one or two places that I can communicate with readers. Facebook, Twitter, and I have a blog. The thing that I like about the blog is I've just used it as a way to explore the world of Survivors Club more. I have a series of flash fiction stories that people can read on my blog, which are stories that are set in the world, but they don't actually touch any of the main characters in the main story. It's sort of, meanwhile, someplace else, something else is going on, and here's what that might look like.
So, has the publisher had any sort of marketing plan that you've been... you know, assisting with, or that was maybe the way you wanted to go or didn't want to go, or I don't want to put you at odds with your publisher, but I am curious how that's maybe assisted you with marketing or with the outreach for the book.
Well, actually, my publisher, Not a Press Publishing, is participating in the Year of Publishing Women, and that's been one of the areas where I feel like I've gotten more publicity than I could have ever gotten on my own, is being a part of that that effort. The other thing that they do, I think, really, really well is they foster a communal kind of collaborative effort among the authors that they represent, where we all feel like we're helping each other out. We're all cross-promoting each other. We're all talking about each other's works, doing reviews for each other. reading each other's books, things like that. And I think that this helps me in getting some of the word out, and also helps me look at other writers' works, see what they're doing, what's working for them in their, you know, in their efforts to promote their own books. Rather than competing against each other, we're all working together.
Do you want to talk just a little bit more about that, Year of Publishing Women, and what that is?
Sure. So the Year of Publishing Women was originally proposed by Camila Shamshi, and it's sort of this idea that I think it comes from a lot of the critique that one of the reasons that women don't win prizes and one of the reasons that women are not represented as much as they are among writers is because they're just not published as often. There is an inherent bias in the publishing industry towards men, and particularly white men, and particularly straight white men. So in an effort to hear the voices of other authors, my publisher is focusing this year on women. I believe next year they're going to be focusing on writers of color. I think their plan is eventually to focus on LGBTQ writers, to just get some underrepresented voices, because there is a whole wealth of stories that are out there, and really good stories that are not necessarily being told or seen by the public because they're not being written by the kind of people that we're used to thinking of as writers.
Awesome. That sounds amazing.
I know. I think especially, I have to get on my little soapbox for a minute here and say this is something I think especially can be problematic in sci-fi. One of the things that I run into a lot is when I say, I'm a writer, the automatic assumption is, well, of course you write romance because you're a woman. And if you don't write romance, then you must write mystery. And if you don't write mystery, then you must write women's fiction, which I don't even understand what women's fiction might be, as if all women only read one type of fiction. So I write sci-fi because I like it.
And that's just so myopic. It just drives me nuts because there are so many women sci-fi writers. There are just so many. I ran into
a thing the other day that there's so many people who don't know that Robin Hobb, who's one of my favorite authors, people don't know that she's a woman because she writes the Assassin's Apprentice series, and it's this amazing fantasy series, and people, she's just one of the canon figures in fantasy nowadays. And people assume that she's a man because she doesn't have an obviously female name.
But she did have to play the game where she has an androgynous name, you know, just like C.J. Sherry and I mean, yep. so many other writers that, yeah, I don't know. That's one of my favorite online arguments to make. But anyway, we have a train that you might hear in the background. So if folks wanted to find out more about the Year of Publishing Women, could they go to the Not a Pipe website and find out more?
Yeah, they could go there. They have links to the original Shamshi Challenge. They have details about what they have done as publishers to support the Year of Publishing Women. If you are a woman and you're writing short stories, they have a call for open submissions for short stories. They're publishing a series on their site, and I think they're going to be doing an anthology collecting that series of short stories. They've got merchandise. They've got, you know, t-shirts and mugs and things like that. So if this is something that you think is important, feel free to put your money where your mouth is.
Excellent. So we like to end every interview with a little spot of inspiration for writers striving to master their craft. Do you have a little piece of wisdom that you would like to leave our listeners with? Best piece of writing advice you've ever received, a quotation that drives you? I'm really hoping for an interpretive dance and I could break out the video camera.
Maybe next time. You know what? I will do an interpretive dance to celebrate the publishing of my third novel. So just make sure that happens. Fans, if you want to see it, you're going to have to keep telling my publisher what a great book I have, so eventually the third book can get published. For now, I think I'm going to just give advice. For aspiring writers, I would say don't think of yourself as aspiring. Nobody has to come around and dub you Lord or Lady, writing writerton of writington on the grain. You are a writer because you're writing.
Excellent. I love it. All right. How can your adoring fans find you?
So my husband the other day, since I'm going to be out of town, said, "Honey, we're going to miss you." And I said, "Well, next time get a scope." He used to be in the military as well, so that's... sorry. So, adoring fans, here's where you can find me. My website is mkmartinwriter.com. You can also find me on Twitter at mkmartinwriter. And you can find me on Facebook, mkmartinwriter.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you. We're really excited about the new book and very excited about the launch party tomorrow. So that's going to be fun, too.
We'll post pictures.
Yay! Yeah. And I think the other thing that if folks get a hold of the book and love it, definitely leave a review on the various websites. I think it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the places, right?
Yep. For West Coast folks, you can go to Powell's. I have to throw out a couple of independent bookstores as well.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yes. So leave reviews.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Really appreciate having you on the show. And we will bring you back in your other role next time for our next interview. So thank you for listening.
Thanks for having me.